Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group Podcast, your source for current issues within the legal practice. Today, the Federal Society's Professional Responsibility and Legal Education Practice Group is hosting a discussion by Richard Brookhiser on his recent book, James Madison, which looks at the life of our fourth president. Mr. Brookhiser has written for National Review since 1977, and he has written numerous books about the Founding Fathers and their era. Joining us and participating in today's discussion is Mr. James Haynes, who serves in the leadership of both our Professional Responsibility and Legal Education Practice Group Executive Committee and our Baltimore Lawyers Chapter. Mr. Haynes has had an active trial and appellate practice and volunteers at several Washington, D.C. area law schools judging moot court competitions. As always, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, so all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. I am David Ray, Practice Group's Associate Director for the Federalist Society, and I'm now pleased to welcome our podcasters, Richard Brookhiser and James Haynes. Mr. Brookhiser's book looks at the life of James Madison. Mr. Brookhiser will be interviewed by James Haynes, and I now turn the program over to Jim Haynes.
Mr. Brookhiser, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
A book about James Madison. One of the less well-known of our founding fathers. What was it that drew you to write about James Madison?
Well, partly that he is, I won't say less well-known, but less done. There was an opportunity there. We've had a rash of books on John Adams, on George Washington. Jefferson is a perennial subject. Alexander Hamilton has been done. But there was really a kind of gap with Madison. Ralph Ketchum wrote a very long book about him back in the early 70s, but very little since then, a few short books here and there. And I think there are a couple reasons for that. Everybody knows who he is, and I think everybody knows that he's the father of the Constitution. That's a moniker that has stuck to him. But there's some problems with him for biographers and for the popular understanding. His life lacks obvious drama. He was not a military man like Washington or even like Hamilton. He didn't go abroad as Adams did or Jefferson did. He was a politician. He was a theorist. But being a theorist is kind of hard to bring to life. Being a politician can be hard to bring to life. He also had a very long career. He dies when he's 85 years old. He had a very active old age and retirement. His career starts very young when he's in his early 20s. There are a lot of moving parts to it, and it seems as if the climax, or the thing for which he is most famous, is his services in the writing and the ratifying of the Constitution. And that all happens when he's in his 30s. So is it a downward arc after that? How do you tell that story? So there was an opportunity there, and there was also a challenge.
What sort of reader did you imagine that you were preparing your book for?
Intelligent general reader. Just someone who wanted to know something about this period of American history and wanted to know about this guy.
Now, you mentioned that there were a lot of moving parts in the life of James Madison. After sort of getting to know him better, did you have a sense that the moving parts were all unrelated and sort of segmented as he moved through his 85 years, most of them in public service? Or did you have a sense and a notion that there were themes that held the life together?
Well, you do find him changing his ground on certain issues. I mean, there are periods in his life when he is arguing for a stronger federal government. There are periods in his life when he seems to be arguing for stronger state governments or for the states to step forward. And he responds to circumstances, and he does he does shift around a little bit. The continuity is how he approaches problems. He is always a thoughtful politician, and both of those are important. He is a politician. He's not John Locke, you know, or he's not Hobbes or someone like that. He is actually in the real world, holding office, setting policies, winning elections. Occasionally, he loses elections, but he is in the arena all of his life. But he also always has to understand what he is doing. He has to simultaneously step back and try to figure out why politics is being conducted the way it is or how it should be conducted, and he tries to get some grasp of it, and then he tries to express that in writing that he does generally for the public, sometimes you know, for himself or in letters. So the way he approaches everything is very consistent over this very long life.
I was curious. I noticed a kind of semi-parallel with the life of the much older and much more eminent George Washington, that James Madison did not travel a great deal outside the United States, that many of the other founders did or had connections or roots outside the 13 states. But Madison was very much of an American, wasn't he?
Well, yes, and part of that, I mean, part of his never going abroad is that travel was always a trial to him. This is a man who was worried about his health all his life. And some of that was in his head. Some of that was hypochondria. But he really was sickly all his life. He complained of what he called bilious attacks. This meant that, you know, coach travel between, say, Philadelphia and New York or his home in Orange County, Virginia, to either of those places, he would have, if it was a public coach, he'd have to ask it to stop so he could go out and relieve himself. I mean, how, you know, how awkward is that? But he, you know, he, that's what he had to do if he had to travel any great distance. And he did have a chance to go to Europe as a diplomat during John Adams' presidency, but he certainly wasn't going to risk an ocean voyage. But he's like Washington in that he, you know, stays in the United States. He's like Washington in that he's also a Virginian. And he's even, in a way, more of a Virginian than Washington was. There's a way that both Madison and Jefferson are kind of archetypal Virginians, perfections of a certain type. I think Washington grew beyond that to become more of a nationalist than either Jefferson or even Madison did.
And you write in your book a great deal about Madison's relationship with George Washington, which was, I gather, a very complex one and a very one that worked on a number of different levels.
A very close one for many years. Madison, who's much younger, a generation younger, he sees that Washington is not only, well, he's the great hero, he's the heavyweight of American political life. I mean, he's first, everybody else is nowhere. So partly for reasons of ambition, but also for reasons of sheer admiration, he attaches himself to the older man. And particularly in the mid to late 1780s, I almost see the relationship as if Madison is a fight coach and Washington is the heavyweight contender. Madison is the guy who is advising him at every step what is happening with the Constitutional Convention, who are the delegates going to be, who is going to be sent from the various states, what is the agenda going to be, shouldn't we set the agenda this way, and then afterwards, keeping Washington informed about the writing of the Federalist Papers, which is going on in New York City with Madison and Hamilton and Jay. Washington agrees to republish them in Virginia. Madison was spending so much time at Mount Vernon in the mid to late 1780s, he was getting his letters there. You know, people would write him at Mount Vernon rather than his home in Montpelier in Orange County. So that's how close they were, and it continues into the beginning of Washington's first term. Madison gives him a lot of advice on protocol and the powers of the executive. And then they begin to drift apart, and this is because of the emergence of the first American two-party system, which pits Alexander Hamilton and ultimately Washington on one side, the Federalist Party, and Madison and Thomas Jefferson on the other side, the first Republican Party.
Now, you had anticipated perhaps the next question I was thinking of asking, which was apparently the other sort of great sort of figure in Madison's life, was Thomas Jefferson, another Virginian, and someone ultimately whom Madison was close to all of his life. What was the difference in the relationship between Madison and Jefferson and the relationship between Madison and Washington?
Well, I think of Jefferson as the cool older brother that Madison never had. And Madison was the eldest child in his family. He was the eldest of a number of siblings. Jefferson is 8 years older, virtually a neighbor. Montpelier and Monticello are not that far apart. It's a day's ride. Both extremely intelligent men, both political men, but different enough to be endlessly fascinating to each other and useful to each other. Jefferson is like a blue jay. You know, he's always finding shiny objects and carrying them back to his nest. And a lot of these shiny objects are things of his own creation, thoughts that he has, starbursts, you know, ideas. And he wants to run them past Madison because he knows what he'll get from Madison. First, he'll get attention. He will get serious, thoughtful attention, and he'll get the attention of a man who has good judgment. And you see this pattern a lot in their correspondence. Jefferson will come up with some idea, you know, how do we rein in Chief Justice Marshall and his court? Or when Jefferson is in France as our minister to France, you know, how can we possibly deal with inequities of the distribution of wealth? I mean, here I am in France, and there are these huge estates, and peasants are only making a shilling a day, and, you know, what can we possibly do about that? Well, here's an idea. And he always knows that Madison is the guy who will take it seriously and raise serious objections if there are objections to be raised. And they both know that. I mean, each man knows that's how the relationship works. So in a way, Madison provides Jefferson some grounding. He provides him with a reality check. Sometimes he gives him very concrete political advice. And my favorite story about that comes from the beginning of the John Adams administration. Adams and Jefferson ran against each other for president in the election of 1796. The first two-party system was already set. It was a very acrimonious election. Adams narrowly wins. But because this is before the 12th Amendment, Jefferson becomes vice president. He's gotten the second highest number of electoral votes, and the Electoral College does not yet recognize tickets as it would in the 12th Amendment. So John Adams is president, his rival Jefferson is vice president. But these two men were friends years ago. They were both diplomats in Europe together. And then Jefferson knew Adams' family. He liked Abigail. You know, they had this relationship once upon a time. So Jefferson is feeling those friendly emotions stirring in him, and he writes President-elect Adams a letter saying that his sincerest wish is that his administration would be happy and glorious, or words to that effect. And then he sends this letter unsealed to James Madison. Madison writes him back and says, "You don't want to send this letter." And he makes a couple of points. He says, "We've just been through a bitter election. What will your supporters feel if this letter leaks out? You know, that you're being nice to your opponent." Then he also says Adams is bound to do things we don't like. And if you have given him written proof of your esteem, that implicates you. So he says, you know, don't send this letter. Then he says, but if you do want me to send it on to Adams, I suggest post-dating it. So you won't know that we've had this conversation. Jefferson ends up not sending the letter. And, you know, he probably, in some part of his mind, he probably expected, maybe even hoped for that advice from Madison. So he wanted to do the friendly thing, but Jefferson's also a politician, and he knows Madison will give him the sober political advice. So that's one example of the dynamic of the relationship the two of them had.
Interestingly, Madison did not think much of John Adams.
No, he didn't. That was the difference between him and Jefferson. Jefferson liked him. He knew him enough to see past the prickliness and the pomposity to the warmth, to the patriotism, to the intelligence. Madison was never cheek by jowl with Adams. He dealt with him from afar, and so he only saw the bad qualities, and he always dismissed him as a kind of a reactionary blowhard.
Interestingly, was John Adams present at the Constitutional Convention?
No, he wasn't, and I think Clinton Rossiter said that if he had been, it would have lasted 2 months longer, just from his own his own speeches. No, he was like Jefferson. He was out of the country. Jefferson was in Paris at the time, and Adams was our minister to Britain in London.
Well, what crossed my mind was the degree to which it seems that Madison's friendship and loyalty seemed to center around those figures who were at the Constitutional Convention rather than the Continental Congress, where Thomas Jefferson was working on the Declaration of Independence earlier.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Madison thought well of Hamilton.
For a while he did, and that's the strangest relationship of all. In some ways they were very different. Madison is from Virginia gentry, you know, wealthy Virginia gentry. Hamilton is the illegitimate orphan from the West Indies. Madison is an immensely learned, well-educated young man. He goes through Princeton, and then he spends an extra year there as the special student of John Witherspoon, the president of Princeton. You know, Hamilton got a kind of helter-skelter, some learning in the Caribbean, and then he was a couple years at King's College, which is now Columbia. Madison was never in the military. Hamilton spent 8 years in the military during the Revolution, starting as an artillery captain and then ending up on Washington's staff. Madison marries very late. When he meets Hamilton, Hamilton is already married and he already has a son. So, you know, there are differences in their background, differences in their personalities. Hamilton is much brasher, always out there. Madison is more reserved, more cautious. But they meet in the Continental Congress as the war is winding down. They see the problems of the government under the Articles of Confederation, the difficulty of raising money, the impossibility of paying off debts, paying off the army first and foremost. And then they meet again in the mid-1780s at the Annapolis Convention, which is in 1786. This is supposed to be a conference among the states to resolve commercial difficulties, such as navigating the Potomac, navigating the Susquehanna River, how do we stop states from interfering with the commerce of neighboring states. And, of course, under the Articles of Confederation, there is no mechanism for a federal government to do that. It's every state for itself.
If I may stop you just for a moment and sort of interpose, why do we contemporary Americans hear so little about the Annapolis Convention?
Well, I think it was very short. First of all, it was no longer than 2 weeks. Only five states were represented, and the total number of delegates was quite small. It was like less than 20 people showed up, and in fact, they adjourned so quickly that as some of the delegates were leaving, they ran into other delegates who were struggling to arrive and come there. Now that was a lot of that was a machination by Madison and Hamilton, who wanted to hijack this conference, this commercial conference, and turn it into an appeal for a constitutional convention, which is what they did. And then, having written that appeal, they wanted to end the thing and get out of town, you know, so no one else would show up and try and change what they had done. So that was a very adroit little maneuver they pulled off. And so the Annapolis Convention in 1786 ends with an appeal for a future convention, which will be the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia from May to September of 1787. And of course, there Madison is there. He attends every session of that. Hamilton is more spotty in his attendance, but then they really bond after the Constitution goes out to the states for ratification. Madison is serving in Congress, which is then meeting in New York City, and that's Hamilton's hometown. And New York is a very problematic state because the governor of New York, George Clinton, does not want the Constitution ratified, and he's a very capable, active man. He wants to stop this thing. Hamilton sees they need a propaganda campaign in New York in favor of the Constitution. So he's looking for co-authors, and he gets John Jay, who's an older diplomat, and James Madison, who's in New York as a congressman, and the three of them begin to write a series of op-ed pieces for the local newspapers, which we now know as the Federalist Papers. And since Jay gets sick very early on in the process, the burden falls entirely on Hamilton and Madison. And the way the division of labor ends up, Hamilton writes 51 of the papers, Madison writes 29, Jay only produces 5 for 85 altogether. But among Madison's 29 are some of the most important.
Now, you had mentioned that George Washington and Alexander Hamilton eventually founded the Federalist Party.
Mm-hmm.
And what was it that drew Madison to found the Republican Party, as it was then called, now the Democratic Party, along with Thomas Jefferson?
Alarm over Hamilton. there were two factors. The first is Hamilton's financial program. Hamilton has a plan for paying off America's war debts, and more than that, for erecting a financial system which is really on the cutting edge of world economics at the time. Hamilton wanted the United States to enter the economic world that Holland and Britain had already entered, really the only two nations on earth that had yet done so. And Madison and Jefferson, I have to say, didn't understand this world. What they saw of it, they disliked. They saw it as for the benefit of Hamilton's banker cronies, the very sorts of people who never paid them enough for the crops they mm-hmm. raised, you know, middlemen, creditors, many of them foreigners. They were just very suspicious of it, hostile to it. They also thought it was unconstitutional, parts of the plan, namely the Bank of the United States. That's not an enumerated power in the Constitution, so how can we have something like that? And this leads to one of the first great clashes of constitutional interpretation, pitting Hamilton versus Madison. So that's one whole area of contention. The other one, which is something you always have to bear in mind when you're reading or thinking about the early republic, George Washington is first inaugurated president in April 1789. The Bastille falls in July. So the French Revolution begins just months into Washington's first term, and then the wars generated by the French Revolution begin shortly after that. And these wars do not end until the Battle of Waterloo in 1815. So the early history of the United States under the Constitution is in the shadow of a world war. And it's a world war that is longer than World Wars I and II put together. It's as violent as either of them. And it's as ideological as the Cold War. And it's pitting France versus a number of other countries, primarily Britain. And these are the two superpowers of the world, and they're in a death struggle for almost 25 years with only one break in 1801. And the United States is a little country on the edge of the world, and mostly we are trying to stay out of this conflagration, but there are all sorts of different ways to do that. And Hamilton's inclinations are always more pro-British. Madison and Jefferson are Francophiles. They are both grateful to France as our ally during the Revolutionary War, and they're also very excited by the French Revolution. They're very hopeful for its success. They ignore its excesses, really right through the Reign of Terror, and until the rise of Napoleon. When Napoleon appears at the very end of the century, they begin to back off a bit because Napoleon is a military despot, and that's exactly the type of person they do not like. So they begin to cool off. But until the end of the 1790s, they're right in there pitching for France all the way.
Well, interestingly, while we tend to think about the development of the United States Constitution and the early republic as being very much a kind of a unique, exceptional, homegrown phenomenon, what you suggest about the influence and the shadow, almost the sort of force exerted by Britain and France in the United States, sort of implies that the intellectual and political life of the United States still rested on the foundations of the Enlightenment in terms of French thinking and pragmatism and traditional rights and the common language in terms of British influence. I probably didn't do justice to each country or to the age, but it indicates a much larger influence for those two foreign powers on the American development, doesn't it?
Well, it comes at us in different ways. All the founders know their British history and their British law. A lot of them are lawyers. So they've read their Blackstone, they've read their Coke, you know, so they're all up to speed on that. They've all read Montesquieu. They think the world of Montesquieu. So this is sort of the early French Enlightenment. You know, you would think Montesquieu's first two names were the Celebrated, because that's what everyone calls him, the Celebrated Montesquieu. Now, the later Enlightenment of Voltaire and Rousseau, they're a little bit aware of that. Benjamin Franklin meets Voltaire. Madison has read some Rousseau. I think one of the most important influences on Madison is the concept of public opinion, which is new in the late 18th century. It was first written about in France in the 1770s, as the, you know, towards the end of the old regime. And then Madison picks this up, and he's actually one of the first people in the English-speaking world to use the phrase public opinion. And he uses that in some of his polemics against Hamilton. And it's a very interesting development, because he is really saying that popular rule establishes a process which is ongoing. It's 24/7.
He uses the image of the Argus. And...
Well, yes, that the people should be like Argus, who was a giant in Greek mythology, and he had 100 eyes, and I believe it was Hercules killed him, and then the eyes went in the tail of a peacock, supposedly. But in one of these essays, Madison says that people should be an Argus, that they should always be vigilant, always watching over their rights, and what is happening to them, how the government may or may not be curtailing them. And this is a shift from the way someone like George Washington would think of popular sovereignty. I mean, they all believe in it. All of them believe in it. But for someone like Washington or Hamilton, the people rule at election time. You know, and they vote for representatives, and then those men should do their jobs for 2 years or 4 years or 6 years or whatever it is, and then there'll be another election, and either they'll be continued in office or new guys will get in. But Madison is saying, no, there's this thing called public opinion, and that is ongoing, it's omnipresent, and this is a good thing, and it should be encouraged, it should be educated. I mean, he's also implying it should be manipulated and led. He doesn't quite come out and say that, but that's a consequence of it. So that's one way that a current of French thought affected his thinking. Now, there's yet another way which the politics of late 18th century France and England affect us, and it's really the rhetoric of party opposition in this country. You know, we borrow a lot of the tropes of what's going on in Europe, and people throw them at each other. The Federalists will say, well, if the Republicans win, they're going to set up guillotines. Hamilton writes a letter, I think it's to his friend Robert Troup, and he says, well, the stakes of this election, of course, are going to be liberty, freedom, prosperity, and heads. So he just tosses that off, like, yeah. If Jefferson wins, they're gonna cut off our heads. Now, that he almost does that as a joke. I'm not clear how serious he is, but then on the other side, the Republican Party of Jefferson and Madison, they do hail the guillotine. They say the execution of Louis XVI is great. There's a fashion in Philadelphia for calling people citizen and citesse. You know, like citoyen, citoyenne. And so there's a lot of, it's like radical chic. But it's all foreign. So we don't really understand it. We're just kind of aping it and borrowing it. And in fairness, no one is actually setting up guillotines. So, you know, there are neither guillotines, nor is there the kind of reactionary repression that Europe will see after Napoleon goes down. But we borrow a lot of that talk, and that inflames American politics and makes it kind of crazy in a way that that's almost hard to understand.
And it was the prestige of George Washington that seemed at least at one point to center the country in terms of enthusiasm, at least about the French Revolution. Isn't that correct?
Well, no one can attack Washington openly. Tom Paine tries it at one point, and that sort of incinerates his reputation. Washington, even people who feel he's gone off the rails, as Jefferson and Madison come to feel, they come to feel that Hamilton has deceived him or is leading him in the wrong direction, but they know they can't attack this guy openly. And another person who's incinerated by trying to do that is a French ambassador to the United States, Edmond Charles Genet, who's over here in the early 1790s, and he wants the United States to actively help France in its wars with Britain. He wants to launch privateers from American ports. He wants to launch an invasion of Spanish territory from American soil. You know, he's got a lot of projects. And he has to be told by the Washington administration that, no, you can't do any of these things. And then he says, well, you know, I'll appeal to the people, you know, over the heads of the administration, because they love France. So when word of that leaks out, then Jefferson writes Madison and says, look, we have to cut our ties with this guy. I mean, this is just political suicide. And we ask for Genet to be recalled. But by this time, there's been a change in regime in revolutionary France, and Genet knows that if he goes home, he'll be guillotined. So he asks if he can stay, and Washington says, well, fine. You know, if you're not a diplomat anymore, you won't be making any trouble. So, yes, you know, please stay if you want to save your life. So he does.
It is interesting, then, to see the degree to which the rhetoric, at least, of the first two political parties was influenced by events totally outside of the United States, seemingly. To change the subject a little bit, who was Edward Coles?
Edward Coles was a Virginian. He was from a, you know, pretty prominent family. He had, an uncle who was a congressman. And he knew both Jefferson and Madison. His older brother had been Jefferson's private secretary when Jefferson was president, and then he himself was James Madison's personal secretary when Madison was president. So he's a younger man. He admires Madison, adores him, you know, just really looks up to him. But when Coles was in college in William & Mary, he became convinced that slavery was wrong. And he decided that when he became an adult, he would do something about it. He puts that on hold while he serves Madison, while he's serving the Madison administration. But once that is over, he takes his slaves, who are not a lot of them, I mean, maybe 20 or so. And he takes them up to Pittsburgh, and they all get on rafts in the Ohio River. And as they are going downstream, he tells them that they are going to the Illinois Territory, which is soon to become a state, and there they will all be freed. Coles is going to move there, and when all the slaves arrive, they will no longer be slaves, they will be free men. And he also sets them up. He buys the heads of households, certain amounts of land for them to farm. And so this is an act of manumission that he accomplishes. And he tells Madison about this. He corresponds with Madison as he's planning this and as he's doing this. And Madison approves. Madison tells him, you know, this is a good thing you're doing, and you're doing it the right way. You're not just, you know, you're not just freeing your slaves and kicking them off into the world. You're setting them up. You're responsibly giving them a leg up. But you know, it's clear that Madison himself, he's too old for this kind of thing. He owns too many slaves. He has about 100. I mean, he can't take this course himself. And then he also tells Coles, I wish you could change their skin color along with their condition. And that, you know, that's kind of a shock to us now reading that. The justification for it is that life for free black people in Illinois was not easy. Illinois had black codes. They were very stringent. Free blacks had to always carry ID, or they were likely to be arrested as escaped slaves. And then there was a push to make Illinois a slave state very early in its history as a state, and Edward Coles feels that he has to run for governor to stop it. And he wins. He becomes governor, and he stops this push to make Illinois a slave state. So, it's a very... the world of freedom in early 19th century Illinois is a very problematic one. And then the ending of the story, at least as far as Madison is concerned, is that when he finally dies in 1836, Coles is sad to learn that he has done no manumissions in his will. And Coles was at Montpelier shortly after Madison died, and he wrote some, they're very sad descriptions of how slave dealers show up, you know, because mm-hmm. they're looking for opportunities to
right.
buy. And, you know, of course, the slaves know what's going on, and they run to the big house, and they say, you know, please, please don't sell us. And he calls it like hawks coming among pigeons. I mean, it's very painful, and it really shows you, you know, some of the grim realities of that world.
Would it be fair to say that in some, at least some small degree, the later career of Abraham Lincoln and the abolition movement was fostered and changed by the fact that Coles contributed to keeping Illinois from becoming a state in which slavery was legal?
Well, sure. You know, Lincoln was born in a slave state, Kentucky, and then as a boy they moved to Indiana, and then the family ends up in Illinois, and yes, that's a big thing. Had Illinois become a slave state, would the adult Lincoln have moved on to a free one? You know, given our view of Lincoln, we would like to think yes, but it certainly is was easier for him that it was not a slave state.
Well, certainly the positions that Madison took or didn't took on the great question of slavery are some of the ones that are hardest for us today to really have much empathy for. But was the real low point of Madison's life and career riding out to Bladensburg, Maryland to see the British regulars who had marched from Benedict and the war as it came to his doorstep?
Well, actually, that moment was why I decided to write the book. That was like the final push to write the book, when I started thinking about the morning of August 24th, 1814. This is 2 years into the War of 1812. It's in Madison's second term as president. He asked Congress to declare war in June of 1812. He had tried for years as Jefferson's Secretary of State and then himself as president, some way both to keep America out of war and to keep the two superpowers off our back. And the superpower who is most able to annoy us, of course, is Britain, because they're the great naval power. So if Britain decides to be tough on neutral shipping, which they define as contraband, that really makes us suffer. We also share a border with the British Empire, because they own Canada, and they, from time to time, they stir up the Indians in what's now the Midwest, you know, who want to resist American expansion and settlement. So finally, Madison decides enough is enough. He asks Congress to declare war in 1812. Well, the beginning of the war is pretty lousy. We haven't fought a land war since the Revolution. Our officer corps, Winfield Scott, who was a young officer in 1812, he looked back late in his life and he said it was imbeciles and ignoramuses. So we had some old revolutionary vets who had all turned to drink, and we had a lot of young officers who were good for nothing, and he just, you know, he shook his head, and certainly it was humiliating. We lost Detroit to an inferior British force. We tried to attack Canada across the Niagara River. The New York State Militia says, "Well, we're only signed up to fight New York. We can't cross the border." So that's another failure. There's some good news at sea, because the Navy is in better shape. It's a humiliation, and part of the responsibility has to rest on Madison's door, because he had very bad Secretary of the Army and Secretary of the Navy. He had two political hacks who, you know, he picked them because they were loyal to him personally in various intra-party fights, but they didn't know anything about the Army or the Navy. The Navy Secretary was a drunk who quit work at noon. You know, and these are the two guys who are going to be your right hands when you declare war on the greatest superpower on earth. It's not very smart.
Was that because Madison perhaps just had a kind of deficit of information experience about war, and therefore made these appointments and treated the Department of War and the Department of the Navy seemingly like political patronage jobs, like the post office or something else?
Not so much a deficit about war, because he was in the Continental Congress during the American Revolution. So he did, you know, he did see that from a political perspective. I think it was a lack of executive ability. You know, because remember that Madison, all his life, he's a legislator. He's in the Virginia legislature, or he's in the Continental Congress, or he is in Congress. And then Jefferson makes him his Secretary of State. But Jefferson is a very hands-on president directing foreign affairs. So Madison really, he doesn't have executive experience, and he doesn't have an executive temper. I mean, he's a legislator, and legislators are coalition builders. And that means, you know, every vote is important. And some of those votes are cast by morons and failures, you know. But each one of them has a vote, so you've got to be nice to them, too. Now, someone like Hamilton, who by now is dead, he's killed in 1804, Hamilton really was a take-charge guy. He had an executive temperament, sometimes too much of a one. You know, he wanted to take charge when he should have held back. But that's just a very different kind of person. Washington also is the obvious example of an executive temperament. So this is a role that Madison has to get used to, especially as a commander-in-chief. You know, not just as a president, but also a war leader.
So we have him on horseback riding toward the Anacostia River and into Prince George's County, Maryland, to Bladensburg in his 60s, pretty much alone as President of the United States, to see the invasion.
Yeah, to see what the British are doing. The British have landed in Maryland. His Secretary of War, new one, the replacement for the lousy guy, is a man named John Armstrong. A lot of abilities in certain ways, but by this point, he and Madison have just personally fallen out. They cannot work together. And Armstrong says, well, the British are obviously bound for Baltimore. Baltimore is a great big port. It's the third largest city in the country. It's strategically important. That's where they're going. What could they possibly want with Washington? And Madison suspects, well, they might want to do something in Washington, but Armstrong, you know, just won't have anything to do with it. The commander in charge of the Potomac Military District is a young, incompetent man, and he can't do anything about it. And to his credit, I think, Madison rides out to Bladensburg to see what is going to happen when the British attack the District of Columbia, and really to face the music. That impressed me, that, you know, here was a guy, he was getting better as an executive, better as a commander-in-chief. We were winning victories in a lot of places, but here is something that's probably not going to end well. You know, this is a day that's not going to be a good day, but nevertheless, 63-year-old James Madison, who has never heard a shot fired in anger, he saddles up, he borrows a pair of pistols, and he rides out to see what the dispositions for battle look like.
And he actually went beyond the American picket lines, didn't he?
Yeah, he rode too far, and there was a horseman who waved him back and said, "No, no, you know, your Secretary of War is back up there on the hill. Don't go this way. The British are just over there." So he's there as the guns go off, and you know, he sees the beginning of the battle. He tells everyone, well, now I should leave. If I stay, I will just be a distraction. I think that was the proper decision. And he sent word back to the White House to his wife, Dolly, to clear out. So she has already, you know, packed up some of the silver and the portrait of George Washington, the Gilbert Stuart portrait. She took that off the wall. And then Madison rides back to Washington, spends a moment in the White House, then goes off across the Potomac to Virginia. And then the British, they win the Battle of Bladensburg, and then they burn all the public buildings in Washington. They torch the Congress building. They eat dinner in the White House, and they burn that. And, you know, in the fires, it's like something in The Lord of the Rings. I mean, just columns of sparks and smoke and fire all night, and Madison must have seen this from over on the Virginia side. And he finds Dolly after a few days, and then he reassembles his cabinet and then goes right back to Washington. And some people are saying, oh, well, let's move the Capitol, you know, let's move it back to Philadelphia or New York, or, you know, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And he says, no, the government is coming back here, and we're just going to keep on with the war. And, of course, the British lose before Baltimore. They lose in an attack on upstate New York and Lake Champlain, and then their final and worst defeat is their attack on New Orleans early in 1815, where Andrew Jackson beats them severely. And the results of the fighting was status quo ante. That's what the diplomats negotiating the peace treaty in Europe came up with. So... was it a draw? I mean, formally, it was. Everything went back to what it was before the guns went off. But it seems to me, when the greatest power on earth is fighting this punky little nation in not quite the middle of nowhere, but close to it, the lesser of the two countries has the bragging rights in the event of a draw. So I think America can justly celebrate the War of 1812, whose bicentennial we will witness this June.
And I was going to ask you why it was that the War of 1812 seemed to slip into such obscurity between the really the Revolution, I suppose, and the Civil War, the Mexican War also being kind of obscure. And was the War of 1812 treated at the time as a national triumph?
Not complete obscurity. I mean, you do know the Star Spangled Banner.
True enough.
I'm sure you know that. I mean, everybody knows that. We sing it at baseball games, and probably a fair number of people know it had something to do with Fort McHenry, and that's the War of 1812. People also know about the Battle of New Orleans. I mean, there was that popular song about Old Hickory said we could take them by surprise. That's been covered a million times since the 50s. So people know about that. But you're right. They don't have a sense of the shape of it, and certainly the shape, since it ends up in status quo, is kind of hard to define. At the time, it was the closest vote to declare war that the United States would ever cast. The partisan divisions were very bitter. The Federalist Party, which was still existed, opposed the War of 1812 to a man. Now, a lot of that was regional. New England hated the war, and they dragged their heels throughout the war. And there was even a push for secession at the very end of the war, the Hartford Convention. It was kind of a threat. The Hartford Convention proposed certain constitutional amendments that New England Federalists wanted, and they said if these don't happen, then we'll call another meeting, which is the threat of secession. It all disappeared after the peace treaty was signed and after the Battle of New Orleans. But that's how bad the feeling was. Also, the first casualties in the war, the first deaths in the War of 1812, were Americans killing each other. There were bad riots in Baltimore, which was a very politically divided city in a politically divided state. And there was a Federalist anti-war newspaper that was attacked twice by mobs. They destroyed the buildings two times. The second time, the Federalists armed themselves and fired back. They killed a rioter. Then they were taken to the jail for their own protection, but the mob broke in the jail and tortured the Federalists for hours. They killed one man. They fatally injured Henry Lee, hero of the Revolutionary War, now an old man. it was bad stuff. You know, there was nasty stuff that went on in the War of 1812.
That was the father of Robert E. Lee, was it not?
Yes. Yes, that's right. And married to Martha, you know, Martha Washington's granddaughter.
Did James Madison really like the city of Washington?
Well, he would flee it in the summer just because it's so horrible there in the summer, and he wanted to be back in Orange County where, you know, it's closer to the Blue Ridge and the air is better. But, you know, he and certainly his wife, Dolly, and I think he let her take the lead on this. Dolly really beautified the White House. She made it a social center. Jefferson gave wonderful intimate dinners at the White House when he was president. When Madison is president, his wife gives big parties, big soirees. She was a very expansive personality. She was really the first political wife. Martha Washington, everybody liked her, but she wasn't particularly political. Abigail Adams was political. She shouldn't have been. All her advice to John was bad. She just confirmed all his prejudices. Jefferson was a widower. So Dolly Madison is the first wife who takes an interest in the political world, really helps her husband, because James Madison is very shy. But Dolly is an extrovert. There's a great moment when Henry Clay says to her, "Everybody loves Mrs. Madison." And she comes right back, "It's because Mrs. Madison loves everybody." Well, you know, that's like two Southerners air kissing, right? But they also, it's also true. I mean, she would rather like you than not. So she, you know, she makes her White House a very bright and inviting place. It's too bad the British had to burn it, but she makes it the first. It's the first time that the White House is a social scene and a social center.
And then, excuse me, go ahead.
No. What were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say that she in your book you mentioned that she hired Benjamin Latrobe, the noted architect and designer who had done other work in Washington, and at least for a while they collaborated on trying to, as you pointed out, beautify the White House and make it into a social center for the city.
And that's where she ends her life. After she's much younger than James Madison, he dies in 1836. She tries to keep the plantation at Montpelier going. Finally, she has to sell it, so she moves to a house that she owns on Lafayette Square, which is still standing, by the way. It's still on a corner of the square. A porch was added to it in a third story, but it's a little brick house, and it's got a plaque on the side of it. And that's where she lives as an old lady, and she is present for the laying of the cornerstone of the Washington Monument, she and Betsy Hamilton, the widow of Alexander, these two old women who, you know, whose husbands went at it, but they're united on the platform when the cornerstone of the Washington Monument is laid.
You mentioned also in your book, sort of toward the latter stages, that as the founders and the revolutionaries in Virginia, specifically, it's sort of a Virginia story, slowly died one after the other, I guess Madison being among the last, or perhaps the last, something that I think you called the mind of Virginia kind of went with them. And it's clear from your book that both Jefferson and Madison lavished their time and their hopes and their attention and their energy on the University of Virginia in Charlottesville.
Mm-hmm.
So what did you mean when you talked about the mind of Virginia?
Well, it's a sad thing. The University of Virginia was Jefferson's great project, and he brought Madison into it. And Madison, ever the loyal friend, takes up the offer and continues to oversee it after Jefferson dies. And Right. They lavish time on this, and they hope it will become a great university. And it just, you know, it just doesn't happen. And there's something about the legacy they leave in Virginia. It does die with them. Maybe it's the long-running effect of being so political. They've turned their ideas into bumper stickers or into slogans, and so they are repeated without being thought about. Someone like Daniel Webster is much more of an heir of Madison, a much more fruitful continuer of his thoughts, and they actually correspond. And Madison advises Webster in some of the struggles over the tariff and nullification in the early 1830s. Doesn't see eye to eye with Webster, by the way, on everything, but clearly they're on the same side, trying to tamp down this extreme states' rightsism that's coming from John C. Calhoun mostly. But someone like that is a much more fruitful heir to Madison than any of the locals, except for Edward Coles, who had to leave.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to free his slaves, he had to get out of there. So it's kind of a poignant ending at the local level. Where it's not poignant is at the national level, because Madison, he left us the legacy of all the work that he did on the Constitution, planning it, defending it, and also the political legacy, the legacy of a two-party system, the understanding of public opinion, all that he did in terms of founding partisan media, which we haven't discussed a lot, but he was a very important early player in the first examples of partisan media. And those institutions, they're all almost as old as the Constitution, but it's sort of his double legacy, both the rules of the game and then how it's actually played.
Well, I think you may have partly anticipated the question that I was going to ask, which was, you know, in the end, the life of James Madison perhaps was most characterized by the fact that he was able, over time, to move from scene to scene and process to process and stage to stage, I guess from the House of Burgesses and colonial Virginia to writing to Daniel Webster about the tariff crisis and John C. Calhoun's doctrines of nullification. But what is it in the end that is truly attractive about James Madison? I ask that in the context of, you know, his hypochondria, his so many people saying that they couldn't hear him when he spoke. So often he seemed to be the man behind the scenes, at the elbow of other men who were more prominent or perhaps greater than he. What is the real attraction, in your view, of Madison's life?
He never quits, and he wants to make this all work. And he does never quit. And when he loses, which, you know, does happen from time to time, he never sulks. He never throws up his hands. He never despairs. He always thinks, all right, what now? What next? Is this loss really so bad as it looks? Is there some way I can retrieve something from it? Can I go on? Is there something else I can do? Is there something else we can do? Maybe we can make this better. He's always thinking in those terms. And this is both as a theoretician and as a practical political man. He is dedicated to making this country and this system as free and as effective as possible, and he never stops.
Well, in terms of your book, obviously we've not had the chance to talk about everything that is in it, and it is a book that is well worth reading. Is there something that you placed in the book that we have not gotten to that particularly seems worth mentioning as we kind of draw to a close here? You mentioned
no, I think we've covered most of the important points. I'll tell you the one little detail that struck me when I first visited Montpelier, and I used this at the very end of the book. They showed me the family graveyard and Madison's grave. And he dies in 1836, and there's this obelisk, which is simply his name and his dates. And then the man who was taking me around said, you know, this is not original. This was put up in 1857. And I said, what did they have, for the 21 years before that? And he said, well, nothing. And I said, really? And he said, well, yes, your family plot told who you were, and your family knew where you were.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was so illuminating about Madison personally. It sort of defined the way he worked with others. I mean, he is a great man who is never afraid to work with other great men, and sometimes in a subsidiary role, sometimes as a peer, sometimes as a leader. But if he has to be the number two guy, he's happy to do that too. And then the other thought was the thought it was similar to the grave of the great English architect who built St. Paul's Cathedral, Christopher Wren, and he's buried in his handiwork, and the tomb says in Latin, if you seek his monument, look about you, meaning the cathedral, and also the city churches of London. Well, all right, Madison's monument is the Constitution. I mean, not his alone, but he's certainly a major player. And our political system, which he does so much to shape in the form that it has. So that's his twin legacy. And just, you know, look at your startup menu on your computer. There it is.
Very interesting. No, it makes sense now that you would have begun your book with the story of Madison riding out on a journey, albeit only to Bladensburg, to find a kind of destiny, and ended it with a story about the way in which he chose to come home. I want to thank you very much for sharing this time with us, and I personally enjoyed reading the book and have certainly enjoyed talking about it.
Great.
Here's David Ray.
Well, I want to thank you both you, Mr. Brookhiser, and Jim, and also thanks to our audience for listening. We hope you enjoyed our podcast, sponsored by our Professional Responsibility and Legal Education Practice Group. And for materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.